9/11 could not have happened, as my good friend Brad Kahn back there stated, without 116 governmental agencies and fail-safe systems failing on that day. The odds of that happening are 4,000,000 to 1. It could not have happened. Okay? Now, lately, even this past week, Condoleezza Rice, and I think Bush 2 days ago, lied again. I mean, they're constant lies. But what did they do? They said that we never could have thought that a plane could have gone into a building. Well, maybe you've been in a cocoon for the past number of years, because in 1993, as you know, see, I know a lot of you know this, I'm just trying to summarize some of this. 1993, they attempted to blow up the World Trade Center. In 1995, testimony came out from that Al-Qaeda had planned to use planes to go in the Sears Tower in Chicago or the World Trade Center in New York. Duh, don't you remember that, guys? I mean, you know, listen. Also, and I'm not even going into all the warnings they had before 9/11 in 2001, which according to my website and the suit we filed, there's 100 warnings they had that we know of now without subpoena power, without depositions, without interrogatories, 100 notices they had, and that's without even seeing the presidential daily briefings. But assume for a minute they didn't know all that. At 8:20 a.m. on 9/11, a plane was missing, off course. Now, I guess the procedure's different because you wanted your second Pearl Harbor. Because do you remember the year before, or 2 years before, when Payne Stewart was flying a plane, and after it went off course, within 3 minutes, the military jets followed it, that escorted it all the way across the United States? Well, that's what happened, because there's a procedure, there's a standard operating procedure. And that procedure is, you know, first you get alongside, you flap your wings, do various things, and if it looks like it's a danger, there's a procedure there, they don't react. It's called shoot down. The order was there to shoot down, which they discussed on 9/12 or 9/13. In the future, we might have to shoot down a plane. Well, those of you who watched the news carefully on 9/11, remember that afternoon? That was another thing that made me realize something was wrong. And that was the fact that the plane in western Pennsylvania was shot down. Okay? Now, don't get us wrong. We're not taking away from any of the people that were involved. Everyone who was murdered on that day, everyone who was murdered that day is a hero. But that plane, the reason is I saw, as I told you, my TV on the, I saw, maybe you did, and you're forgetting it, I saw a live broadcast from 5 miles away with reporters saying, look at the debris on the ground here. This is from that plane. Well, unless I've learned something wrong in mathematics or science, if something crashes here, it doesn't bounce 5 miles back there. Okay? The only way is there was a hole in the plane, it was shot down. But why wasn't the plane at the Pentagon shot down? And why wasn't, and Ellen and I have discussed this, and I have like 5 minutes left, so I'm going to go short, but at 8:46 when the first plane hit, if jets were scrambled then, which should have been at 8:20 or 8:25, but even at 8:46 if jet planes were scrambled, and not from Cape Cod, and not at one-third throttle, but from Long Island or McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey, or Pomona in New Jersey, the second plane should have never been allowed into the airspace of New York or close enough to the World Trade Center. Ellen's husband wouldn't be here today, but that second building wouldn't have been hit, and that's the first building that went down. There, it is an absolute disgrace. It's criminal. The president should be held for impeachment. People should go to jail. Treason has occurred. It's an absolute disgrace, and we're going to pursue it. Just think about it. We're 2 1/3 years after 9/11, and not one person has been brought to justice. Not one military person has been brought up for court-martial. Why? But now, what do we have? We have an arrogance in the White House, don't we? Bush, a month ago, puts in his ad the 9/11. Well, I'm very thankful you're that dumb, or your staff is, because he has brought it to light again. Now we at least have John Kerry talking about it. We had written to every presidential candidate to talk about 9/11. They didn't. We've approached the peace people, the anti-war people. If 9/11 didn't happen, we wouldn't have been in Iraq. They go together hand in hand. You know, I understand, thank you. I understand people don't want to mix issues. But as long as we stay separate, as long as we stay divided, they win. We have to come together. Coming out of here this afternoon, I'll be sitting here, I'll be interested in your input. We have to come together, focus together. One way to do it is go to our website, 911forthetruth.com. Sign and pass on that petition. Send $9.11. Tell your friends to send that money in. Don't get me wrong. Once we get enough money in here, you know, we'll give it to other organizations. Right now, the only vehicle, I got to use Brad Kahn again. He's like a mentor, and he talks to me all the time. He said that the Ellen Mariani lawsuit has taken what all of you have done, and we've crossed the 50-yard line. But now the only vehicle to get the goal line, the only vehicle to get it now, not 40 years from now, we can find out 40 years, we must find out now for the security of this country. The only vehicle, and I'm not trying to be self-righteous, is the Ellen Mariani case, the RICO lawsuit against this administration. And we have to push in that direction to get everyone behind that, to force the issues and get the truth out from everyone here. I picked up interesting information this week. If you know stuff, get it to me. There's someone out, by the way, on the internet who's, I don't want to even mention her name, who's trying to down us and saying we're not doing the right thing. That person is obviously well-funded from the right, because if you really are working with us, you call me up and you say, Phil, let me give you a point. You're doing this wrong. We are focused together. This is such an honor to be out here. We plan to go to Toronto, but more important, we plan to go to court as soon as we can on some procedural moves to get this out. Now, the media that's here is great, but the national media is not, because they're trying to hide this story. We have to be united. We have to stay direct on the questions, the direct questions that have to be answered, the stand-down orders, these type of questions, you know, the notice that you had, why weren't planes scrambled, you know, what was going on at that time. Together, we can do it. I know what I really have to address. The rights, this administration has done more than any other administration in the past 200 years of this country to take away your rights. They created the Stabilization Act within 2 weeks after 9/11. They created Patriot Act 1 without members of Congress even knowing what they're passing. They created Patriot Act 2. Now, we're thankful that the courts have ruled some of those provisions unconstitutional. That's why we still have faith in the court system for our case. Then they announced the photographing of people and fingerprinting of certain people coming into this country. Those machines probably cost $2,000 a machine. I'm sure they're billing the country $30,000 a machine. I'm sure it's another Cheney like Halliburton company. But then, and do you know, or you didn't listen, in January this year they announced that people here, all of us, if we fly in the United States of America, we're going to be color-coded by this summer. And if you're color-coded red, because you're subversive, which I guess I will be, you're not going to be able to fly. This is Big Brother. This is 1984, 20 years later. You got to stand up. On our website, we're saying a peaceful revolution. Many times, I'm not sure if Ellen said it today, Ellen Mariani says, walk with her. Walk with her to seek the truth. We got to go hand in hand and shoulder to shoulder to demand the truth in a peaceful revolution way. The people in this room is great. Next time, we hope we have 10 times as many here. But the point is, our petition needs more than 7,000 people. We need 700,000. We need 7 million. It's an issue. Your freedom is at stake, ladies and gentlemen. This case has undermined us more than anything else. The arrogance of this administration must be held accountable. And together, together we can all do that. Because if not, we're in serious trouble. Let me just look at my notes, see if I missed anything else that I really... Oh, I know. This is an interesting point. Well, people have mentioned Operation Northwood, and I don't want to be redundant, but that's a good way to get people to realize what's going on, because they don't want to believe the government's doing it. Roosevelt with Pearl Harbor, it's too far back. But Operation Northwood, if you tie it in the fact that the Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted to destroy American citizens and property and blame it on Cuba, and add the line, the tagline, that President John F. Kennedy stopped that. Because people still know, or even if they're young, they know about John F. Kennedy. And that's probably, unless you buy the single bullet theory, which I don't, that's probably one of the reasons why he was assassinated. This is important to think about. And also, we've heard about the evidence being taken away and destroyed. You know what? If we called in the TV show CSI, we would have had a better investigation of 9/11 that has occurred from this administration. And I'm not trying to be funny with that, but it's the truth. And in closing, because I know they're going to be coming out here for a minute, this conference is so important. You are so important. It's not just because you spent this weekend here. the individuals who have written about, and the books that are upstairs, and the tapes, and buy them and read them and digest them, is so important, because this group, these individuals of researchers from around the world, have looked into a matter that we shouldn't have had to look into. This is something that should have been automatic. You know, remember, they knew nothing about 9/11, but yet that afternoon they had the photographs of the 19 people up on TV with their names. Now, what has to be investigated, because the word is that six of them are still alive and well in Saudi Arabia. But that's the part of the Senate report, the Congress report, which was blacked out by the president. To allow him to continue to do these type things is an absolute disgrace. But it's so important what everyone has done, but now we have to become focused on how to get this message out. You know, delivering the letter to find out how Willie Brown, the mayor here, heard about not to fly that day. How many other people? I have been contacted by former members of the CIA and FBI, by a translator. I think it's the same one who hailed the news conference the other day, that they've been told to lie and change testimony. People know what happened on that day. They're fearful. They're fearful what's going to happen. But they have to step forward right now. And together, really, all of us can accomplish this. We have to leave here with a sense of knowledge that, number one, 9/11 had to be involved with this. They had to be involved with this administration. There's no way 9/11 could have happened that day. And to allow the murdering of 3,000 people to go unanswered, to blame it on Al-Qaeda, when the real person at fault is George W. Bush and his administration. We will succeed with all of your efforts together. Please make sure you give your input. You can call me. My number is on there. There's a petition outside. Pick up this petition if you can. Sign it on the website. Show me by 7,000 that multiple I told you. Show me by a week from now that we'll have 14,000 or 30,000. It can happen if you do it. Send it to everyone on your email. Stay focused. Get directed here. But get the message out. The message that must come forth from here is the message of, without going to the conspiratory theories, which could be right, just on the unanswered questions of 9/11, it could not have happened without this administration doing it. They must be held accountable for it. We will do everything, Ellen Mary and I, to see that the RICO suit goes forward, for justice to prevail. If we work together, I know that George W. Bush will be out of office before the November elections if you spread the word. Thank you very much. Thank you. 9/11forthetruth.com. Thank you very much.
That was Phil Berg, attorney representing Ellen Mariani in her RICO suit against the Bush administration. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. I'm playing audio from the International Inquiry on the Unanswered Questions of 9/11, a conference which was held from March 26th through 28th in San Francisco. In another piece of news related to getting to the bottom of the events of 9/11, Michael Moore's new documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11, was awarded the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival this weekend. No documentary has been so honored since the 1950s. The film's release has been suppressed by the Disney Corporation that owns the film's distribution company because of its criticism of the Bush administration. Next, Riva Entin of the National Lawyers Guild on the government threats to our rights and freedoms in the aftermath of 9/11. Then we'll hear the audio from a 2003 documentary, Aftermath, The Unanswered Questions of 9/11, produced by the Guerrilla News Network.
Hi, good morning, folks. I want to start with some good news, because it's really hard to find it these days. But the Chronicle is talking about how these 9/11 hearings are weakening his likelihood to get reelected. And as you all know, that will not resolve the issue, but we're making waves. And we really need to make bigger waves, because this government is so corrupt. And lest we forget, this president was not elected. So I do believe that 9/11 was used as a pretext for the cutback on civil liberties. And I want to set the stage a little bit, going back to early after 9/11 and what some of our government officials said to set the stage. Sandra Day O'Connor, visiting Ground Zero soon after 9/11, said, "We're likely to experience more restrictions on personal freedom than has ever been the case in this country." Little did we know. Rumsfeld said, "All Americans need to watch what they say, watch what they do, for this is not a time for remarks like that." And this was after Bill Maher referred to that it's not really courageous to drop bombs. Ashcroft, "Let the terrorists among us be warned. If you overstay your visa even one day, we will arrest you." You know, I'm going to talk about how immigrants are becoming synonymous with the concept of terrorists. Ashcroft to the Senate Judiciary, "To those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this. Your tactics only aid terrorists. They give ammunition to America's enemies and pause to America's friends." And that's actually language that's very close to the definition of treason. And it was really aimed at Senator Wellstone, who was, as we remember, one of the more courageous senators at the time who had dared to ask questions. And then in terms of how long this is possibly going to go on, they're telling us. Cheney told us October 19th, 01, right? Just a month later. "The war on terrorism may never end. It's the new normalcy." Ominous. They're telling us. They have long-term plans. We need to have long-term plans. Now, you know, if we go back to that period, I think it's really important when you talk about the cutback on civil liberties to validate the need for safety and security, and that what 9/11 meant to a lot of people is that finally in this country we're not necessarily secure in our homes and in our communities with our family, and that everybody around the world has that common belief, which is that we all have a right to be safe and secure. And it's important to raise that and to validate that. And my answer, this is my answer to how we can be safe and secure in the borders of our country, is we have to look at our foreign policy and change our foreign policy so we don't exploit people around the world. We have military bases in 100 countries around the world. And right after 9/11, there were a lot of teenagers who knew exactly what was going on. They said, "It's our turn. What do we expect? We've been doing it to people around the world." They got it. So when you talk about this, it's really important to validate that it's important to feel safe, and we have a right to feel safe. But my belief, and I believe many of you here, believe that shredding the U.S. Constitution is not the way to make us safe. So in this context, I don't know who here knows, remembers Morton Sobel, who is still alive, who is the Ethel and Julius Rosenberg co-defendant who served 16 years in prison because of the McCarthy period. And he was unjustly convicted and served 16 years, much of it in Alcatraz, and he believes the times are worse now than then. And I think it's a sobering thought, a sobering thought. The main reason that he believes and I believe that it's worse now is there is an incredible consolidation of executive power. There are three branches of government created for a reason, and it's clear which branch is dominant right now. It's the executive, and I'll give some specifics. But I want to talk about something, I want to read something that he said, which is why we all need to fight hard and why you're sitting here at 9 o'clock in the morning. Let me just read his perspective. He got out of prison in 1969, and he said, 1969 marked the awakening of the American people to the true meaning of the Vietnamese War. What a contrast with the Korean War period 20 years before. Ethel and Julius could never have been executed in 1969. People could no longer be frightened into submission the way they had been in the 1950s. Our job is not to be frightened into submission. We need to demand that the rule of law is followed and that our elected officials follow their oath of office, which is following the Constitution. And one quote that I like is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights says, "My job is to protect the Constitution from its enemies. Right now, its enemies are the White House and the Justice Department." That's our job. It is patriotic to defend the Constitution. Okay, I categorize it's Patriot 1, pieces of Patriot 2, Homeland Security, over 30 executive orders. I just group them all in post 9/11 repressive legislation. And I see that there are four pieces that sum up what this body of new law has done. One is that just about everything about us is transparent. Okay? Medical records, financial records, education records, our phones can be more easily tapped. They can enter your home without a warrant if you're not there. If you are there, they still need a warrant, but warrantless searches, if you're not there, are allowed. There's very little about us there, you know, by the internet, library records, as you know, everything is transparent. Just about everything is transparent with us. The reverse, which is a scary reverse, is guess what? More about them is secret, hidden behind the curtain. Freedom of Information Act requests? Forget it. Ashcroft has given a directive to all of his Department of Justice guys saying, if you get a FOIA request and you want to say no, and I will defend your right to say no. You know, so that makes all of our work advocating for example, you need the information about what emissions are coming out of your local neighborhood plant. If you can't get that information, you can't advocate. We're transparent, they're secret. It's a war on immigrants. As I said, they're basically making immigrants synonymous with terrorists, and it's everything from special registration, which we somewhat succeeded in ending, although deportations are happening more now than ever any time since after World War I. That's clearly the front line, and those of us who do not have immigration vulnerabilities need to take more risks and be more courageous and demand that everybody's entitled to due process and constitutional rights. And finally, it's a war on dissent, and that's what I believe 9/11 was a pretext for, which is they want to solidify, they, and at this point it's an unelected president and his executive branch officials, want to solidify their hold on policy, which of course is anti-democratic. And the most egregious violation of the right to dissent, I believe, is the definition of domestic terrorist, which in the Patriot Act, and you'll see that said verbatim in the film, but it is so broad that Martin Luther King clearly would have been defined as a domestic terrorist, and that is chilling. So again, the summary is we're transparent, they're secret, war on immigrants, war on dissent, and all of this is done through a consolidation of executive power. One piece of Patriot 2, and the reason the Patriot 2 didn't pass is because it got leaked and we have created a climate which makes it more difficult for them to do so. But one of the pieces that got in, and Congress, both houses of Congress voted for it, we can't just blame the president. It's one of the scariest things I believe, which is that the executive branch has a right to withhold information about surveillance, budget, and procedure. Withhold information from both the legislative branch and the judicial branch in the name of national security. And Congress, I believe, abdicated its responsibility by passing it all on to the executive branch. Okay? The San Francisco Labor Council did a report on Patriot 1 and 2, which I think is a very good summary of the climate that we're living in. The proposed Patriot Act 2, coupled with Patriot Act 1 and RICO, created the legal architecture for a police state in the United States. The purpose of this legislation is to allow for U.S. global expansion unhindered by organized domestic opposition. These laws and proposed legislation are clearly intended to prevent resistance to U.S. corporate control and allow preemptive attacks on those organizations and individuals the government considers a threat. How are they getting away with this? Some of it is, and this came up yesterday in the press conference, like fear, fear, fear. It was all manufacturing fear. And guess what? Some people in the government are really admitting that these fears are manufactured. WorldNetDaily.com, it's worth checking, in January 03, there's this Capitol Hill Blue Report. Sources within the FBI and CIA say, the administration is pressuring intelligence agencies to develop something, anything, to support terrorism alerts issued by the White House and Department of Homeland Security. Quote, most alerts are issued without any concrete data to back up the assumptions, end quote. The current warning level of yellow or elevated has repeatedly been in place, and the FBI never meant for all of these warnings to be made public. And this is kind of interesting. FBI and CIA sources said, a recent White House memo listed the war on terrorism as a definitive advantage and fundraising tool. Yeah. All right, Getting close to the end of my time, I am going to be talking more tomorrow morning. But in terms of the film, one thing that I find kind of uplifting, and again, it's hard to find uplifting things, is I'm pretty sure I was interviewed for this film a year ago. I'm pretty sure it was last spring. And I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure it was under 100 municipalities. I think I said something like 60. You'll check me. Municipalities had voted to repeal all or part of the Patriot Act. Well, guess what? As of now, it's 274. Now, that's a groundswell. That's 274 cities and counties, four states, Maine just passed it, and that represents almost 49 million people are saying you've gone too far. I have a minute, and that's really uplifting. So basically, your job, again, is to make waves, to shake this country up, to demand. And the other thing in terms of the film is that it's still unanswered questions. They're not answering those questions. This film is not dated, as you all know. And what we need to look at is what happened on 9/11 and what has happened since, and demand, again, that we exercise our democratic right to demand that this country follow the law, follow the Constitution, follow international law, frankly, in terms of U.S. foreign policy. And when we do that, that's the only way we will bring about peace in this world. Thank you.
Thanks to Reeve Antine, that's really good news about how many cities are standing up against the Patriot Act. And now we're going to see the Guerrilla News Network's film Aftermath, Unanswered Questions from 9/11. This film was finished in January 2003, and you can check out the Guerrilla News Network on the internet at guerrillanews.net. So let's go with the film.
George Soros, billionaire philanthropist, addressed students and faculty at the University of Pennsylvania on April 8, 2002.
I find the foreign policy of the Bush administration exceedingly dangerous. Although the terrorist threat is real and we must defend against it, we are going about it the wrong way. What makes the situation so dangerous is that nobody dares to say so. The nation is endangered. Therefore, it's unpatriotic to criticize our leader. That is not what has made this country great. The strength of this country lies in the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the freedom of speech and thought.
Weeks leading up to the one-year anniversary of 9/11, GNN approached nine people who have dedicated themselves to investigating how and why the United States was attacked that September day. We asked them 11 questions. Unanswered question number one: to what extent should airlines have been prepared for September 11th? Mary Schiavo is representing families of passengers of hijacked 9/11 planes in lawsuits against United and American Airlines.
What was really interesting is what people thought, what the government told people and how the government acted versus the real facts.
First of all, the question is not what they should have known. And I believe I can show you in just a few seconds, the question is, what did they know? And believe me, they knew a lot. Because on a September day, four planes were hijacked in Islamic Jihad. It shocked the world and will forever change the law under which we act. You think I'm talking about September 11th. I'm not. I'm talking about September 12th, 1970. Yes, we had an Islamic Jihad. Four airplanes were hijacked. Actually, it was supposed to be five. They were taken to Jordan. They were blown up on September 12th, 1970. So in the wake of September 11, 2001, when we heard carriers and governments alike saying, oh, no one could have foreseen this. No one knew that this was coming. No one knew that there were any risks like this in the world, is absolutely false. Why? Because we know that aviation is an industry which criminals go after, terrorists seek, and hijackers prey upon to make their political statements in the world. We know this.
So September 11 was literally a repeat of a fact and of an event that had occurred 30 years earlier in history.
The Bush administration has changed its official story about how prepared it was for the threat of terrorism around September 11. Unanswered question number two, what did the Bush administration know and when? Mike Ruperts from The Wilderness was one of the first independent news sources to raise the issue of government foreknowledge.
First of all, it's imperative to note that the Bush administration is absolutely and totally lying when it says, golly gee, we had no idea that aircraft could have been used as weapons of mass destruction to attack the United States. We know, of course, that Bush had clear briefings that Al-Qaeda might be hijacking airplanes, but gee, the press forgot to tell you that on October the 24th through the 26th of 2000, the Pentagon held detailed drills practicing for an airliner being crashed into the Pentagon. The major media didn't tell you that at the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy in July of 2001, just 2 months before the attacks, all the airspace was closed off. The summit conference area was ringed with anti-aircraft guns, and the Los Angeles Times reported clearly that Egyptian intelligence and other intelligence services were afraid that hijacked aircraft would be crashed into the G8 summit to kill President Bush. It's a total lie that the administration had no knowledge. It's also a lie that the administration had no advance warning of the attacks. Intelligence reports from France, from Germany, from Russia, from Egypt, from Jordan, all of which taken together, show clearly that the United States government had been warned that in the week of September the 9th, commercial airliners would be hijacked and crashed into the World Trade Center, and that ultimately, through other warnings, that they would involve aircraft from American and United Airlines. Those are very specific warnings, and that's just what we know now to this day.
The FAA, NORAD, and the U.S. military have standard operating procedures that are routinely deployed during hijackings. Unanswered question number three. Why wasn't the U.S. military able to intercept the hijacked planes? Nafiz Ahmed's book, The War on Freedom, is one of the most detailed investigations of 9/11.
Standard operating procedures dictate that as soon as a plane flies off course, the FAA will contact the plane and try to ask them what is going on. If there is a problem or if they cannot establish radio contact, then immediately the FAA will contact the Pentagon, who will, within a matter of minutes, a maximum of 10 minutes normally, will scramble fighter jets to intercept the civilian plane and to analyze the situation and see what is going on.
In his book, Nafiz documents a timeline of September 11th, showing how the attacks should have been prevented, intercepted, or terminated. In the case of American Airlines Flight 77, which departed Dulles and was crashed into the Pentagon, the FAA lost contact at 8:50 a.m. However, fighters were not scrambled until 9:24 a.m., a delay of over 30 minutes.
Now, this sort of direct violation of standard operating procedures is inconceivable without some kind of high-level government approval. If we try to explain it by using the incompetence theory, it doesn't make sense. For example, if it was incompetent, we would expect that there would have been a normal inquiry into what went wrong. We would have expected that there would be some kind of reprimands, that certain officials would be downgraded, or they would lose their jobs, or something would have happened to correct the situation. But we find that there has been no such reprimands at all.
Unanswered question number four. How did the administration respond to the failures of the military and intelligence agencies on 9/11? David McMichael is an ex-CIA analyst and former editor of Unclassified, the magazine of the Association of National Security Alumni.
Contrary to the situation in countries with parliamentary governments, where the responsible cabinet officer following a disaster of any sort is expected to, and almost always does, resign, go fall on his sword or something like that. In the United States, this simply doesn't happen. That's not our tradition.
Despite the breakdown under his acting leadership on September 11th, General Richard B. Myers was promoted to chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest military post in the country.
The worse the failure of intelligence, the more the intelligence system gets rewarded in terms of greater budgets and more personnel on the grounds, of course, that they failed because they didn't have the resources. Well, that's often done in the military side as well. A sufficient military failure will usually bring on demands not so much for the sacking of the generals who participated in the failure, but in increasing their budget so that arguably it won't happen again.
In his 2003 budget, President Bush proposed an allocation of $396 billion for national defense, an increase of $48 billion over 2002, the largest single increase in military spending since the height of the Vietnam War. Unanswered question number 5. What ties, if any, did the U.S. government and intelligence agencies have with the terrorists or their supporters? Michel Chosedowski's research at the Center for Research on Globalization has exposed links between the Bush administration and the terrorists.
It's well documented that the Taliban was supported by the Clinton administration. They would never have formed a government had it not been for U.S. military aid, which was channeled through Pakistan into services intelligence. And that same organization supports the development of these terrorist organizations.
During the Soviet-Afghani War of the 1980s, Pakistan's Inner Services Intelligence Agency served as the critical link between the CIA and frontline rebel groups, one of which was Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network.
The Al-Qaeda network is considered by the CIA to be an intelligence asset, and intelligence assets are controlled by their sponsors. That does not, of course, mean that Al-Qaeda is necessarily pro-American. It means that Al-Qaeda is being used to perform certain functions for the U.S. Intelligence apparatus. And it goes through a whole complex group of intermediaries. And that's why Pakistan's military intelligence has played a very important role in that context. It's important to understand that the man who, according to the FBI, is considered to be the so-called money man behind the 9/11 terrorists. I'm talking about the head of Pakistan's military intelligence, Mohammed Ahmad.
In the aftermath of 9/11, the FBI confirmed that General Ahmed, then head of Pakistan's ISI, had authorized a $100,000 wire transfer to Mohammed Atta, the alleged ringleader of the terrorist hijackers.
Well, this same individual was on an official visit to Washington from the 4th to the 13th of September, and he met Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, George Tenet, his counterpart. Now, the question you have to ask yourself, if the money man behind 9/11 is in Washington meeting top officials, and at the same time sending money to the terrorists, doesn't it sound, what is the proximity group of this individual from the sociological point of view, okay? He has links with the terrorists, he has links with the Bush administration. He's buddy-buddy with George Tenet, he's buddy-buddy with Mohammed Atta. Does that not suggest that senior Bush officials should at least give us some answers of what they were doing with this guy?
Unanswered question number 6. Were there plans for a war in Central Asia prior to September 11th?
This war was coming for a long time. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who had been Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, but who also worked in intelligence roles for Presidents Reagan and Bush 1, co-founder of the Trilateral Commission. He wrote a book in 1997 called The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. And at three specific places in that book, he says, the key to America's control of the world in the 21st century is the control of Eurasia.
In support of his thesis, Brzezinski states, a power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions and about three-fourths of the world's known energy resources.
And then he says that without an attack on the order of Pearl Harbor or without a direct external threat, there was no way that the American people would support the imperial mobilization necessary to control Central Asia. And in this book, again, written in 1997, Brzezinski had a map of where the next world conflict was going to be. And you look at this map in the book, and it's exactly where we're fighting now.
Unanswered question number 7. Is there an underlying motive, besides the war on terror, for the U.S. military presence in Central Asia? Peter Dale Scott has written extensively about hidden agendas in U.S. foreign policy.
There are people in the administration who believe out and out that this is the American century, that it is the time for American hegemony. Both Republicans and Democrats have said we shouldn't worry so much about what our allies think.
Despite a lack of support from America's traditional allies, the Bush administration continues to pursue military action in Central Asia.
But it's, I think, pretty clear now to everybody that America has a oil geostrategy in that part of the world.
The U.S. National Energy Policy Report of 2001, authored by Vice President Dick Cheney, formerly one of America's richest and most powerful oil industry executives, demanded a priority on easing U.S. access to Persian Gulf oil supplies.
America needs to control the world oil system. And the fact that we have put U.S. troops in Georgia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, even in Kyrgyzstan, 200 miles from the West Chinese border, all those troops there are nominally in the name of fighting the terrorists, but in reality, they have established an American presence in the great oil basin of the Caspian, and people more and more admitting that America is a serious player in that area now because of the troops we've put in.
On October 6, 2002, the UK Observer reported, the Bush administration, intimately entwined with the global oil industry, is keen to pounce on Iraq's massive untapped oil reserves, the second biggest in the world after Saudi Arabia's. Unanswered question number 8. Is there any historical evidence to suggest that the government may have used the 9/11 attacks to justify its war in Central Asia? Alex Jones is a television and radio broadcaster who has publicly questioned the Bush administration's version of what happened on September 11th.
Governments always get caught engaging in terrorist attacks against their own populations to rally them for war or for a domestic crackdown. We saw William McKinley's Navy in the 1890s blowing up their own ship in Havana Harbor as a pretext for war with the Spanish government. And that's now admitted fact. We saw Adolf Hitler blow up his own Reichstag as a pretext for martial law. Firebomb their own capital. Nazi documents have been released, now a part of historical record. Then, of course, we saw December 7th with the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. It's now been released that 12 days before, they had Admiral Yamamoto's communique that the Japanese were going to be attacking Pearl Harbor. One of the best examples we have of the U.S. government planning terrorist attacks against its own institutions is the North Woods document. This is a confirmed, admitted document, declassified just a few years ago.
In Body of Secrets, his best-selling expose of the National Security Agency, author James Bamford revealed that Operation North Woods called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., and for a U.S. ship to be blown up in Guantanamo Bay, all in an effort to galvanize American public support for a war against Cuba.
And they say in the Northwoods document, casualty list in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of indignation. We certainly saw a helpful wave of indignation after September 11th.
Unanswered question number 9. How has the government's reaction to the terrorist attacks impacted the rule of law in the United States? John Judge is a member of the Washington Peace Center and has researched the post 9/11 effects on U.S. civil liberties.
As of September the 11th, the entire country went into continuity of government, which is a special government that does not rely on the elected representatives, but in fact puts a small group of people in power. When you go into a declared war or a state of national emergency, which is what they went into on September 11th, legal authorities change. Hundreds of laws allow new power and new authorities for a select few people. Decisions are made not by the overt government, but by now an acknowledged shadow government. That's who's making these decisions, is DOD, FEMA, and the NSA. That's who's running the country since September 11th. They're not making it very visible, but they studied conventional explosives and weapons, chemical and biological weapons and nuclear weapons, as a three-stage approach to terrorism and counterterrorism, and at each of those levels, they laid out maps that would take away more and more of the civil liberties. Eventually, when you go to martial law or into these emergency situations, they can set up detention camps and go into certain neighborhoods and round people up. The highway system, the phone system, communications, mass media, mail, all come under offices of emergency preparedness and military control once you go into these scenarios.
Unanswered question number 10. How has recent legislation, like the Patriot Act and Homeland Security Bill, affected the lives of American people? Reva Entine is an executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
One of the greatest ironies, along with the tragedy of the Patriot Act, is that it's called Patriot. In fact, it is patriotic to defend the Constitution, and what the Patriot Act does is dismantle the Constitution.
In October 2001, the USA Patriot Act was passed into law, granting unprecedented levels of power to the Justice Department.
The greatest thing that it did is it created a new federal crime of domestic terrorism.
Under the Patriot Act, a definition of domestic terrorism is activities that involve acts dangerous to human life, that violate the laws of the U.S. or any state, and appear to be intended to influence the policy of government by intimidation or coercion.
That's domestic terrorism. Now, intimidation or coercion are very mild words when you think about it. What about people going out on strike? What about Rosa Parks sitting in the front of the bus? What about the sit-ins at the lunch counters? Those are all intended to intimidate or coerce government institutions. And if somebody had the possibility of being injured as a result, that would have been domestic terrorism. Martin Luther King would have been a domestic terrorist. In addition to this new federal crime of domestic terrorism, some of the aspects that are quite troubling include this sneak and peek provision. So now the police can go in to your house and search your house without a warrant if you're not there. They also have this roving wiretap provision, where it used to be that they would have to get a warrant for your particular phone, and now the warrant applies to any phone that you might touch. That could be your mother's phone, that could be your friend's phone. Any phone you might touch is subject to a wiretap.
Also in the Patriot Act is the new designation of civilians as enemy combatants.
Citizens deemed enemy combatants can be held indefinitely with no charges against them, no right to see an attorney, no right to go before a judge. And this category of enemy combatant isn't even defined. So at this point, anybody who's suspect can be denied all due process rights guaranteed under the Constitution. The Homeland Security Act, which passed about a year later in November 2002, outlines in great detail the degree to which the government can now spy, listen in, record, get access to internet, library cards, bookstore records, medical records, school records, phone conversations. The Patriot Act did some of this. The Homeland Security expands it so that there's really no area of our lives that are free from government intrusion.
In conclusion, we asked our interviewees, what are your final thoughts and what can we do?
On September the 11th, four commercial airliners were hijacked. Two of them were crashed into the World Trade Center buildings in Manhattan, New York. One was crashed in Pennsylvania, and another was crashed into the Pentagon. This set off a crossing the Rubicon of human existence, a change in our lifestyle, a change in human civilization, which people are just beginning to understand about a year after the fact. That was a day that changed all of our lives forever in ways that we're just beginning to see. But the run-up to September the 11th, the historical context in which it occurred, is a much darker, much deeper political and economic story that cannot be explained away by the trite and simplistic explanations given by the administration or the news media.
Well, I don't think we yet know what happened on September the 11th, but we're being presented in the same way that we always are, with a world that we know nothing about, with people that supposedly were told hate us for reasons we can't comprehend. We're being told, for instance, that the reason that they bombed the trade towers and the Pentagon is that they hate us because we're a democracy, because we're a pluralist society, because we have an open society, and they can't stand that, or because we're large and have a great deal of wealth. Well, if that's the case, why aren't they bombing Canada? Canada's a pluralist, large society, but it has a much different foreign policy, doesn't it? And so what's happened is that the American people, separated from their own history, have no idea what has been done in their name all around the world in those intervening 50 years since the end of World War II.
It was Mussolini who said it, and not only him, that war is the health of the state. In other words, in time of war, the people who govern are given typically almost free rein to do as they wish without much question. All people who govern, and I remember George Bush has said it on at least two occasions, you know, it'd be so much easier if I were a dictator. I paraphrase closely. This is what the people who govern want. I mean, no one in a position of power, you know, wishes to be restrained by such things as law, you know, or constitutions or public opinion. I mean, a simple examination of history through a political science lens will tell you that. So, yes, people seize these opportunities and run with them.
Just after September 11th, there was a great deal of sympathy from Europe, from Russia, from everyone. And at that time, the Bush administration was able to pursue a variety of international policies that had previously been vehemently rejected by its own allies. What's happening now is that as the United States continues with the war on terror, including the upcoming imminent invasion of Iraq, threats against Saudi Arabia, threats against Iran, threats against many, many countries around the world, which happen to be of strategic interest to the United States, the US allies have grown increasingly worried about US policy, which is basically very unilateral and is based on a lack of consultation with its allies. So I think public opinion is now beginning to go back to the pre-September 11th stage of hostility towards US policy.
I like to quote John Adams, who I think put his nail on the head. He said, it's the established order of things that whenever a nation rises to such a height of power that it loses its wisdom and moderation, it will in the end also lose its power, which will come back when its sense of moderation returns. Now, he was talking about Great Britain, but what was true of Britain then, and I think he was absolutely right, and it was true of Napoleon, who went crazy, thought he could march into the heart of Russia, the heart of Asia, and it was a disaster. Hitler thought he could march into the heart of Asia, it was a disaster. We are about to march into the heart of Asia, apparently. And if we do, and it's not clear that we will, but if we did, I think that it would be seen 100 years from now as the beginning of the decline of American hegemony.
Yeah, 1 year later, in the aftermath of September 11, the Bush administration is waging a war in Iraq, in Palestine, in Afghanistan. It's a war without borders, it's a war of conquest. It responds to economic and strategic considerations. It has nothing to do with the war on terrorism. Within the United States, fundamental freedoms have been rescinded through the Patriot Act. Fundamental rights of free expression are being, again, also rescinded. People are being arrested arbitrarily for presumed links to the terrorists, when in fact the people who have ordered these arrests themselves have links to the terrorists. That's the question we have to ask, and that's what defines the criminalization of the state. It's when war criminals call the shots and decide who are criminals.
Years from now, when people analyze what happened in the wake of 9/11, it will be a very, very dark day in the history of American legislation and legal history, because for the government to rush to protect corporations, foreign corporations and airlines and negligent wrongdoers against dead and dying and injured Americans, it will be a very dark day. And they were willing to strip them of their legal rights to do so. Shocking. and to do that in retrospect, to harm them in hindsight because of what the government and the airlines failed to do, it will be a very dark day in American legal history. And probably worst of all is the realization, and many senators have now admitted it, that they were contacted by lobbyists seeking a bailout and immunity for the negligent, not on September 12th or 13th or 14th. On September 11th, the lobbying started. While bodies were still burning, Congress was crafting protections for the negligent against the burning and dead.
Dissent has never been more critical for us to engage in with all of the energy and all of the commitment that we can muster. Because without these voices of dissent, we will not be the full society that we cherish. And the government is taking us on an illegal path. And it is our voices that must demand that they follow the Constitution and follow the law. When people say what we should be doing, people need to mobilize at the local level, at the grassroots level. There are now about 30 municipalities around the country that have passed resolutions to demand repeal of the Patriot Act. It's a very good thing for people to do. People are also negotiating at the local level with their local law enforcement that local law enforcement should not cooperate with federal law enforcement in terms of INS or the Department of Justice, the FBI. People need to encourage people to speak out, encourage their local governments to speak out.
As this system squeezes more and more people, as this system begins to dominate more and more people and displace more and more people, folks are going to be looking for answers. You need to be educated to be leaders in your area to give them those answers and how we can rebuild our society on decency and honor and things that have really made societies work in the past. We've got to start honoring creativity, honoring individuality, and not this mass-marketed slave hell that they've created. Now is the time to fight this dehumanization. Now is the time to realize you're special, and you have power, and you can affect change, and that we're in a war for the very future of humanity. It's that important, and you're a soldier on the front line. So get out there and take it back to them, 110%. You don't have a choice, ladies and gentlemen. Run your own life, or somebody else is going to run it for you.
And you were listening to the audio of the film Aftermath, The Unanswered Questions of 9/11, produced in 2003 by the Guerrilla News Network. You've been listening to the presentations from the International Inquiry into 9/11 that took place from March 26th through 29th in San Francisco. We'll continue with more from that inquiry next week. Thanks to Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio for her recordings of the conference. For more programming from TUC Radio, visit her website, tucradio.org. And to contact this program, visit unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
By unwelcome travelers.